Hello and welcome to Behind the Buyouts, the Deals podcast, where we speak to private equity and venture capital practitioners about their deals and deal making. I'm your guest host, Nikita Satiraju, senior reporter at The Deal. We have with us today Mike Esposito, co-founder of Franchise Equity Partners, which invests in franchise operators in the consumer mass market. He's here to talk to us about FEP strategy, the franchising industry, and his expectations for 2025 M&A. Mike, thanks so much for being here.
Very happy to be here. Thank you very much.
So let's start a little bit with your career path. I would love to know how you went from Goldman Sachs investment banking division to investing in the franchising industry.
Yeah, certainly not a straight line, was it? I had a wonderful career at Goldman Sachs. I was there for almost 30 years and I really grew up there. Loved it. It was a fantastic place. I spent most of my career working with financial services companies, mostly on M&A and capital markets activity. So banks, insurance companies, asset managers. And so probably couldn't be further away from the franchise space. But coincidentally, relatively late in my career, I had a little side hustle, which was getting involved in Jersey Mike's. And at this point, I have 5 Jersey Mike stores in Massachusetts, and it's been a fantastic investment. I've got a great operator who runs it. It happens to be my brother-in-law. And we got into the brand about 5 or 6 years ago, just as it was really taking off. And it's performed really, really well. We've got a huge amount of respect for the company and the brand. And we're continuing to do more. But it was that kind of whetted my appetite and introduced me to franchising. And so I left Goldman Sachs in 2020. And after briefly considering whether I should just spend the rest of my life on the beach, I decided to do something new. And we got onto this idea of forming Franchise Equity Partners.
And thanks to your wife for the idea around Jersey Mike's, right?
Yeah. My wife happened to grow up on the Jersey Shore and grew up on the Jersey Mike sandwiches. And she's the one who really suggested for me to do it. I didn't know much about it at the time. I had had it maybe once or twice. But it kind of forced me to do the research around it and start to realize that it's a great brand. It's got had at the time a lot of white space, great performance at the store levels, both in terms of same store sales growth and the margin structure at the stores. And, you know, all of that, I think, were things that confirmed that it was probably worthwhile. And she had great advice for me to get into the system.
Absolutely. And your co-founder, Scott Romanoff, also is Goldman Sachs alum. How did you both meet and the idea for him to partner with you on FEP? I'd love to know a little bit of background there as well.
Yeah, so we were both partners for a long period of time. Scott and I worked together at Goldman. So he was also a financial services banker. And so we knew each other very well going into it. And coincidentally, we were both contemplating leaving Goldman about the same time. And I left probably 6 or 9 months earlier before he did. So I was hounding him at some point about leaving. And we got talking and we decided that we wanted to do an investing business. But we decided the last thing the world needed was another pure play private equity firm. We really had no edge in that whatsoever. There's so many great firms out there. And we didn't really feel like that was going to be something that was unique and differentiated. And so, you know, in part leveraging off the Jersey Mike's experience, but coincidentally, we had a bunch of friends who were in and around these franchising sectors. We have a great friend who was a partner at Goldman who left and he became a large auto dealer. And he'd been executing on an auto dealer roll-up over the last several years. We had another friend whose dad was a big Budweiser distributor in Florida. And we got talking to him about it. And so it started out very much focused on restaurants. And we started getting open to these other sectors. And what we realized is that there's these iconic brands that have these distribution systems. And what we realized is that most of these industries and systems were relatively recession resistant. They had family ownership in them. In many of these verticals we ultimately got involved in, there's not a lot of private equity. And the businesses have very, very attractive cash on cash return features, dividend yield, if you will. And most of the sectors were going through consolidation. And so you had family ownership in consolidating industries. And even with the wealthiest families, sooner or later, they need more money, either to affect M&A or to take advantage of intergenerational wealth transfer, or to just take some money off the table. And so we realized that these industries tended to be a bit capital starved, but needed the capital to affect those sorts of things. And we started really digging in on the franchise space as a result of that. And we ended up forming Franchise Equity Partners. We now focus on five key verticals. We focus on restaurants, auto dealers, heavy equipment dealers like John Deere, Caterpillar, beverage distributors, both soft drinks, non-alc and alc, and then other consumer and business services. And just a very, very big swath of the economy across those different verticals.
And outside of your diversified approach towards the industries itself, the kind of capital you provide is also, I think there are different types that you provide depending upon the deal. I'd love to know a little bit about how you support these companies.
Yeah. So one of the things that we observed as we were going through this journey was, as I said, there's not a lot of private equity in many of these spaces. And so, for example, there's really little to no private equity in the auto dealer community. There's little to no private equity in beverage distribution. There's little to no private equity in heavy equipment. And what we observed was that the brands act as a quasi-parent, and the brands are very protective, rightfully so, of the companies that operate, the dealers and distributors and franchisees that operate with their brand. And what we realized that was really important was that if we were to do this, we couldn't kick out the families. We couldn't leverage the businesses up to crazy amounts. And we couldn't have the mentality that, like typical private equity, we were going to take control, kick out the family ownership, and then sell the business in 5 years. And so we've created very flexible capital that can do something that's a little bit unnatural for most private equity firms, which is we often invest in a way that we describe as minority, passive, and permanent. And so the concept is we take a minority equity stake, less than 50%. We are passive investors so that the family management team have a ton of skin in the game. If we're minority, they're majority, they have more skin in the game than we do. And we don't consider ourselves operators. And so they retain control of all the day-to-day decisions. And then we can invest for a very long period of time. And at this point, we're happy to get into it more, but probably about 2/3 of our investments look like that, minority, passive, and permanent, whereas about 1/3 of them today are more traditional control investments, all within that franchise system.
That's really interesting. So is 100% of the deals that you do, are they with family founders, or are there people that have gotten institutional capital before?
There's both. I would say the vast, vast majority of our deals have a very significant owner. Generally speaking, it is a family. And generally speaking, it's a second, third, I think in one case, fourth generation family. So a couple of the control deals we've done in a way where we've had to bring in new management, come on to this later. But for example, the most recent deal we announced where we bought close to 40 Valvoline instant oil changes, we were doing an equity carve out from Valvoline and we had to bring in a whole management team. But generally speaking, what we've done is we've invested with families.
And you also have a set of characteristics that you're looking at when you dig deep into the business itself in terms of the locations and other sort of financial metrics. I'd love to know a little bit more about when things start to get attractive for you.
Most of what we do, not all, but most of what we do is multi-unit retail. And I would say when we're in that world, multi-unit retail world, you know, there's a couple of different lenses and screens that we think about. First and foremost, I would say brand and brand momentum. And so, you know, there's clearly in these different sectors, brands that are on a good trajectory. And what does that mean? It generally means that they have very good same-store sales performance, oftentimes and ideally driven by transaction growth, volume growth, as opposed to price. Number two, in growing concepts where the brand has been proven, but there's still a lot of white space. And so for us, and again, this will depend on the different sectors, but maybe to pick restaurants for a second. In the restaurant space, what is a proven brand? You could debate that. But for us, it's probably something north of 250 stores, that the brand has north of 250 stores. And ideally, you can see it having ultimately several thousand units. And so there's the same store sales performance, there's the white space, and then there's clearly the economics. You know, the unit level economics and how that then impacts returns. So one of the things that we've observed across these different sectors is the margin structure can vary wildly. And again, maybe thinking about restaurants, best in class restaurant concepts have north of a 20% EBITDA margin, and more challenging concepts are probably less than 10%. And when you're at a less than 10% margin, it doesn't take a lot to get you upside down very quickly. You know, you could have a few months where you're off in terms of volume, and all of a sudden you're losing money. And so we're very focused on that. And then we're also very focused, particularly on the growth-oriented models where you're hoping to have more white space. What's the return on investment? And you think about that EBITDA relative to the cost of investment. And generally speaking, a return we look for is, call it north of 20% on new builds on an unlevered basis. And again, not every system delivers that. And so lots of things. We obviously care very much about being aligned with the franchisor and having franchisors that care about us. And then lastly, the management team. We generally don't do turnarounds. And so we want to invest in best-in-class management teams that are looking for a partner.
Absolutely. And then the last thing that you mentioned when we last spoke of very interesting as well is you kind of keep an eye on the potential for disruption from Amazon. And I'd love to know that piece of the investment thesis as well.
Yeah. So, and we can talk more about it, and I'll come on to Amazon in 1 second. But like in anything else, when you're in these investments, possibly for a long period of time, you do think about the disruptive forces that are existential threats, if you will. In the auto industry, clearly electrification is one of those. In food and beverage, Ozempic and GLP-1s are a big piece of that. But maybe across most of our businesses, direct to consumer is a big threat, because at the end of the day, most of multi-unit retail is kind of last mile to the customer. And so one thing we really think very hard about is what can disrupt us and how risky is disruption. So the nice thing about food is that has to be local. The nice thing about auto is that most people want to go see their cars. The nice thing about heavy equipment is that, again, it needs to be relatively local. The customer wants to have the service associated with that. And the nice thing about a lot of beverage distribution is it's actually protected by state law. And so there's very specific reasons why e-commerce can't disrupt a bunch of these things. And so there's other pieces of multi-unit retail that we look at that have that risk embedded in them. And, you know, we're much more sensitive about that and the stability of what we think will be the investment in those disruptive places where we see e-commerce taking a hold.
Absolutely. That definitely makes sense. And the one thing that I'm curious about when you talk about potentially long holds, is there a timeline or a limit? Is it like beyond 7 years that you hope to hold on to these companies, beyond 10 years? What does that look like?
Very flexible. And I think, you know, a lot of it's going to depend on many things in terms of how the investments perform, where we are in the capital structure, what the brands want. But we will probably have a range of outcomes on this. And my guess is in certain cases, we could end up holding things much longer than 10 years.
Wow. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the specific investments you've made as well. One that's very interesting to me is Precision Garage Door Franchisee that you invested in. I'd love to talk about how you found that investment and what you hope to do with it.
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned up front, we focus on these five verticals: restaurants, auto dealers, heavy equipment dealers, beverage distributors, and other consumer and business services. And when we started, we thought the vast majority of our investing would be done in the auto dealer space and the restaurant space. And that's because they're very big sectors. There's a huge amount of activity M&A-wise in those sectors. And so we just thought those would be our biggest pieces of our investments. And we found that our fifth vertical, or other consumer and business services, has proven to be the most interesting. And that's in part because of some of the comments I made before on the margin challenges in restaurants, but it's also in part because we really like diversity. And the more diversified a portfolio we can create, the better. And so we started mapping very early on the other consumer business services. And one sector we got onto was residential services. And residential service, a vast category, it happens to be almost as big as quick service restaurants. So it's a very big category. It is dominated by mom and pops, so still very fragmented. In a lot of ways, it looks like fast food did 25 years ago, you know, before the rise of the McDonald's and Taco Bell. So it's dominated by mom and pops, yet it's consolidating around branded companies for the same reason in many ways that fast food has done that. And so we started looking at the sector very actively, And we fell in love with the Neighbourly system. Neighbourly is a collection of home service brands that's owned by KKR, has a holding company called Neighbourly, but they've got many brands underneath it. And we happen to make an investment of 100% ownership of the largest franchisee in the Neighbourly system, which is a company involved with what's called Precision Door. It's the garage door repair company. Great business, very much like what I described before in terms of high margins, a lot of white space, this whole idea using things like digital marketing and disintermediate mom and pops. We think there's many ways to grow via consolidation, via market share takeaway, and via going in with white space opportunities. And we've got a great management team around that. We've got a great partnership with Neighbourly and the brand. And over time, what we hope to do is get into other home service businesses. And so we just recently expanded into a second one of their brands, which is Mr. Rooter, which is a plumbing company. And it would be probably pretty logical for us to get into other repair-oriented brands like electric, like HVAC, and Neighbourly has very good brands in those sectors. And so we closed on an investment about a year ago, and it's gone really, really well so far.
Absolutely. And then the other one that you mentioned that is going to be a focus for FEP in 2025 is early education. I imagine there are a lot of the same tailwinds. Could you talk a little bit about what the goal is there for the coming year?
Yeah. So, and again, in this whole theme of diversification and looking for spaces that have good tailwinds and good economics, early education would be another great example of that. So on the early education side, in terms of tailwinds, as we have a wealthier population and people caring deeply about their children, looking for ways to provide children with opportunities prior to kindergarten. And so early education is a great space. And there are a number of franchise concepts in that. Primrose would be an example of that. But there's several franchise concepts. And there's also a number of company-owned models that have gotten quite scaled. Again, when you look at the unit economics, these schools, these boxes, tend to operate at oftentimes north of a 20% EBITDA margin. So you have a really good tailwind in terms of the demand side to it. You've got good margin structure at the school level. You still have a reasonable amount of white space. You don't have too many totally branded national companies at this point. So there's the opportunity to really roll things up and become more consolidated over time. And so we like a lot of those dynamics. Like any of these spaces, there's always challenges. And obviously, educating young children, because these children are going to be less than five in most cases, is not a straightforward exercise. There's all kinds of risks associated with that. Obviously, that's a critical thing to get right. And then also, you know, the interplay with governments is also interesting and potentially challenging. So on the one hand, governments are trying to do more to support pre-K education. And when they push that out into the private sector, that can be really attractive, but sometimes they're pushing it into the public schools. That's a very state-oriented policy. And so where you're looking for these schools is very important given some of those dynamics.
That's really interesting. I didn't think about the regulatory aspect for education. What else is on the docket for FEP next year? International expansion is something that you mentioned. I'd love to know more about that as well.
Yeah. So taking a step back, franchising is prevalent in the United States, but it's prevalent internationally. By the way, franchising has been around since the 1800s. It's an old concept. I think Singer Sewing Machine may have been the first. Coca-Cola began with franchising in the 1800s. Like, everybody thinks of fast food as the classic franchising sector, but I don't think fast food really became franchised until the 1930s. But it's been around for a long time, and it's been around internationally for a long time. And so thus far, we've focused all of our efforts on the United States. We like the United States a lot. It's a great market. We live here. But again, with this theme of diversification, we'd very much like to be international. And so we've been looking at things, particularly in Europe, Canada, and a bit in Latin America. And again, we'll look across all of our verticals, but we're finding that restaurants, for example, can be more attractive internationally than they are in the US. And some of the classic tier one brands in the United States, take the KFCs or the Pizza Huts, in some ways do better internationally than they do in the US. And so we're looking actively at that. Now, obviously, if we're going to do that, we're going to want deep local partners to do that with. We're going to want attractive markets. And so we're looking at a combination of a lot in Europe, a lot in Western Europe, but also Eastern Europe. And I would say we'll look across all our verticals, but probably restaurants will be a bigger focus. And a lot of these operators have what you call master franchising agreements in the international markets, which allow them to operate as a franchisee and quasi-franchisor, which we like too, because you can then develop your own stores, but to the extent you wanted to, you could also outsource, if you will, to other franchisees in your system. But you control that market along with the brand to build out the store system in some of these markets.
And as a master franchisor, do they get more flexibility in terms of maybe how the stores look and what you can do with sort of the menu and things like that?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, the brands determine that, as they should, and they're very protective of the look of the stores, the use of the brand, as they should be. But I would say that at the end of the day, I feel it's something where the franchisor is aligned with the ultimate franchisor, because everybody wants to sell product. And it's an opportunity to, I don't want to say rebrand, but it's certainly tailor a brand for the local market. And there are obviously differences. For example, we looked at a great chicken concept in the UK. And one of the things they did was the food was halal certified, which probably would work well in the United States, but definitely worked well in the UK. In that instance, some of the branding they did around the store level was quite different than the branding that was used in the United States. It was certainly younger, hipper, louder music in the store. And when you looked at the demographic that was actually in the store itself, it definitely skewed younger. And so it's interesting because you have an opportunity, you know, there's decent brand awareness of some of these American brands, but you have a real opportunity to kind of reposition the brands. And I think one thing that's challenging for some of the American brands today is that they skew older, particularly the legacy brands, they skew older. And we've noticed that the ones that are most successful today are the brands that skew more Gen Z, millennial. And you can take some of these legacy brands and reposition them where there's some degree of brand awareness, but you have the opportunity to really reposition a brand in an international market.
That is really interesting. I mean, I'm from India and the food in like McDonald's and Taco Bell is definitely a lot different than what I get here. So absolutely understand that. I want to circle back a little bit to FEP's launch because we didn't really touch on that. You partnered with HPS to launch the farm. Was that always the plan? How did that organically develop as you and Scott kind of discussed your options?
Yeah. So when you think about launching an investing platform, there's lots of different ways people can go. And we're fortunate coming out of Goldman, we had a lot of friends who had done this. And so we had watched them, we spoke to them, we learned from them. And fundamentally, there's lots of different ways you can go about doing this. But I think the debate we had was whether to do something smaller, you know, where we raised capital from friends and family, or did something much more scaled. And the advantage of doing something smaller is that you've got more control yourself of it. The advantage of doing something scaled is that while you give up some degree of control, you can ultimately invest in bigger and more likely better companies. And more importantly, you can hire better people. And we debated that. We debated that till the end. What we decided to do is we ultimately went out and met probably 25 different investors. And all of them were people that we had connections with. And ultimately, we found HPS, which was a firm we knew well. Scott Kapnick, who runs the firm, happened to be our boss at Goldman Sachs many, many years ago. He used to run investment banking. And so it was a natural place. I happened, when I left Goldman, I coincidentally was an operating partner, still am an operating partner at HPS. So had good connectivity there. And we got into discussions with them. And ultimately, they agreed to put $1 billion against this concept. And as I said, there was a high level of trust, I think, on both sides of the equation, both with HPS and us and with us in HPS. And at the same time, it was a leaping off point. And you never know what you're going to get yourself into. We kind of held our breath a bit. And they've turned out to be an amazing partner, just a phenomenal partner. You know, in addition to giving us money, and money in some ways is a commodity, they've just been a great partner. And so they'll see things in their network that we might not see. We've had opportunities to get them involved in lending transactions, the back of some of the things that we've sourced and seen. They've been very helpful in helping us look at how we grow our infrastructure and some of our systems over time. And so it's been extremely collaborative, and it's been a great relationship. Obviously, they just announced that they're selling to BlackRock, which is, you know, obviously a large publicly traded asset manager. And I think it's a terrific opportunity for them. And the good news is, I don't think it's going to change our lives at all here at FEP. They continue to be very enthusiastic of our strategy, as does BlackRock.
And you're pretty far along with putting that capital to work as well, right? The money that they invested in FEP?
Yes. We've invested about 2/3 of our capital at this point. So we'll get on to thinking about what to do next in terms of fundraising. But HPS is very excited about putting more money into FEP. And so that will be a very logical place to go. But yeah, we've been fortunate. We've made investments across each of our 5 verticals. I think we now own something like 800 retail units. So we own 300 Taco Bells, 225 Auntie Anne's, Jamba Juice, Cinnabon, 160 Planet Fitnesses, 30 auto dealerships, now almost 40 Valvoline instant oil changes. So a real cross section across our 5 different verticals.
For sure. That's really interesting. How has the franchising industry evolved over the years? Is there anything interesting over the past 3 years, especially since you invested in such an interesting time for M&A in general, with like post-lockdowns and everything? I'd be curious to know if there's anything that's really stood out to you as having changed over time.
You know, it's interesting. I think one big thing, I guess this maybe is relevant across a bunch of this multi-unit retail, certainly relevant in the restaurant space, is the idea of the benefits of a franchising model versus a company-owned model. And in the last 20 years, people, I guess, off the back of McDonald's and Yum, you know, with Taco Bell, KFC, and Pizza Hut, the last 20 years, the common wisdom was franchising was the better model to have. And the reasoning was basically, you as the brand owner, capital light, you focus on what you're really good at, which is brand standards, growing the brand via best-in-class marketing, and then leave the hustle, the street hustle, to operators locally and these great entrepreneurs to drive the brand. And that was a proven model, highly successful model. In the last 5 to 10 years, you've seen a new class of companies that have taken a very different approach, which is more of a company-owned model. And, you know, great examples of that would be Cava, Sweetgreen, Dutch Brothers, Shake Shack. And, you know, all these are predominantly company-owned models. And what's interesting is those company-owned models today, despite being, quote, capital heavy, trade in the public markets at a premium to most of the classic franchising systems. And so when you look at where those companies all trade on a multiple basis, PE multiple or EBITDA multiple basis, they trade at a distinct premium to Yum, to restaurant brands, to McDonald's. Now, I would argue the reason they traded a distinct premium is all about their growth and growth potential in white space, not about the model in which they choose. And so when you look at those brands I mentioned with Dutch Brothers, Sweetgreen, Cava, they've got a huge amount of white space. It's been a model that's proven out. Chipotle, by the way, would be another. And they're adding a lot of stores and therefore adding a lot of growth. And I think that more than anything else, I'm still a big believer in the franchising model. And I, for all the reasons I mentioned before, I still think that it's the model that is a winning model. And I think an interesting place to look at this ultimately is going to be in the coffee space. And I say that because when you look at where the growth is going on now in coffee, you've got Dutch Brothers and you've got 7 Brew that are kind of really breaking out from the pack. And 7 Brew is a franchise model. Dutch Brothers is a company-owned model. And I would argue that there's a little bit of a mentality of let's build it as fast as we can. And I think that it's getting control of that white space and getting control of territory and building the brand through that. And I think what Seven Brews has done is really interesting, because what they've done is they probably have, I don't know now, 250 stores in the ground, but they've partnered with some of the best franchise operators in the country with very big development agreements to go out and build territories. And so in this land grab mentality, they've got probably, I don't know what the number is, but it's probably 25 to 30 different franchisees that are really good operators, that are well capitalized, that are going to go out and do that as quickly as they can. Dutch Bros is going to be a bit more constrained because it's one company. Now you can hire a lot of real estate professionals, go do that. But to some extent, even they have limited resources relative to these 25, 30 franchise operators, and they've got limited ability to scale. So it's going to be an interesting battle to see. They've got relatively similar business models with relatively similar products, but very different go-to-market strategies. And that will be one to watch.
Absolutely. And I feel like in the coffee space too, like outside of like there's Starbucks and then there's like nothing in between. And then there are these growing concepts. So there's just so much space for people to really grab if they go and do it the right way. So it definitely would be an interesting space, like you said.
It'll be a fascinating category because you have Starbucks that's obviously had all its troubles. I think everybody believes Brian Nichols is going to fix that. They'll undoubtedly take some share back. Dunkin' has not lost any share. It's actually gained share in the last 10 years. So it remains an extremely strong brand. But then you have the emergence of these new ones.
Absolutely. And lastly, I can't let you go without asking what your expectations are for 2025 and M&A in general in the franchising category. Do you think the volumes will be better than they were in 2024?
Yeah, I do. I would say, first off, if you look at the equity market itself, obviously it's boomed, particularly post the election. And I think there's this view that, broadly speaking, there's going to be deregulation, probably greater consolidation. Things we're talking about in this conversation are not mega cap mergers, but I think that there's going to be more M&A generally in the economy over the next 2 to 3 years. And by the way, that's debatable. There's certain elements within the Trump administration that likes what the FTC has been doing. But I think if I were a betting man, I would say that there's going to be more consolidation generally in the economy. I think specifically as you get down now to the world that we play in, I think that two or three things are starting to loosen. One is interest rates. So interest rates are coming down. They were a lot higher in the last 3 years than they were previously. That made it very hard for buyers to finance things inexpensively. As that's starting to change, I think that's going to undoubtedly help. Number two, there's been a lot of pressure on top line across every one of the sectors we look at. Whether it's auto, where unit volumes are down probably 5% where they should be, whether it's restaurants where traffic patterns are bad, whether it's beverage, even would you consider beer or soda to be a very stable category, that's down in terms of volume. So volumes are down across these mass market consumer businesses, and it feels like that's on a cusp of changing. We haven't quite seen it firmly in our businesses today. But I think the optimism and what's gone on in the market will spill down and trickle down in a way that should positively impact that. And so I think with a little bit better performance in these companies, clearly with better interest rates, with a more enthusiastic merger market, we're expecting to see more activity for sure. 23 was a slow year. 24 was a slow year. But I think 25 should be much better.
So is there anything that we didn't touch upon that you think is an interesting thing to talk about, either about FEP or the franchising industry in general?
Yeah, so I appreciate that. There is one other thing I'd like to mention about FEP. Whenever I talk about this, I always precede it with, I'm careful about not talking out of both sides of my mouth. So although we often do these minority investments and we are definitively passive, we look for ways that we can be complementary to our management teams. So I always say, we're not going to be able to tell you as a management team how to go compensate a sales force or your general manager in the store. We're not going to be able to tell you exactly if you're a car dealer, how to move your used car inventory. But we like to be complementary and add certain skills and insights. And so we do that through a couple different ways. So one way is clearly we've got a deal team. We've got both the capital markets expertise. We have a professional operating partner of ours named Robert Daniel, who came out of the bank finance world. And so with every one of our portfolio companies, we've been taking over the bank financing, refinancing out debt, getting better terms in terms of rates, getting better terms in terms of covenants. We've got a whole deal team that does M&A modeling. And so if consolidation is important, we can model up a deal. And we generally do that bottoms up, whether it's a restaurant, an auto dealer, whatever it might be. And so we've got this corporate finance, capital markets capability. But in addition to that, we've got a data science team. So we have all kinds of now proprietary insights that we use to help our companies. So as examples, we web scrape restaurant pricing. So if you're a Taco Bell operator, we can tell you where a chicken burrito is priced in your stores versus every competitor around you, and where your state and your county is priced relative to the system. We also have relatively good insight into same-store sales performance. And so we can look at our operators or companies that we're looking at and see how they're performing relative to the system. Sometimes brands provide that information, but a lot of times they don't. We can get that information. We have access to credit card data. In the auto space and auto dealers, we have 85% of the inventory in the United States in our database. And so again, we can tell if a Dodge or a Ram pickup truck is getting over inventoried in your local market, and you've got more than your competitors in the local market, it's probably going to lead to bad pricing behavior in the next few months. And so we have that kind of insight and that data. We've done all kinds of work around white space analysis. Where should you go? Why should you go there? What markets make sense? What markets don't make sense? And so again, we don't consider ourselves operators, but we want to be helpful to our operators. And so whether it's taking off the back, the heavy duty capital markets, corporate finance work, whether it's providing insights on the pricing, or it's building dashboards for them, which again, our data science team can do, we try to add a lot of value in that way. So on the one hand, we're not going to tell you how to operate a company. On the other hand, we like to plug in and try to help in our own ways.
That is really great. How big is the FEP team right now?
We're about 25 people now. And I neglected to mention, as part of that, the final piece, which is actually in some ways the most important, is we have a group of operating partners at a senior level who all came out of these industries. And so, for example, in the auto space, we have a guy named Mark Lenave, who used to run sales, marketing, dealer relationships at Ford. And before that, he was at General Motors. We have a guy named Don Reese, who used to run a number of large private auto dealership businesses. In the construction space, we have a guy named Doug Hare. Doug was a senior executive at Caterpillar. We have a guy named Malcolm Rhodes, who came out of John Deere. In the beverage space, we have a guy named Matt Hughes, who came out of Coca-Cola and was one of the top 10 guys at Coca-Cola, basically built out Coke's elk strategy. In the restaurant space, we have a guy named Kevin Burke, who was the biggest investment banker, developed his own firm called Trinity in the restaurant space. So that's just a few of them. But against each of these spaces, we have these people with deep, deep experience and connections in the ecosystems of these industries. And again, they're available. They're always involved in our investments, helping us think through, but ultimately helping our operators think about how we can connect them to different OEMs or dealers or what have you.
That's really great. Definitely know Kevin. I've spoken to him before on the restaurant space. So thank you so much for a great conversation, Mike. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Nikita. I really appreciate it too. Thank you very much.
I'm Nikita Sathyaraju, senior reporter at The Deal. Thanks for tuning in to Behind the Buyouts.